one of the many strange things in this war. I mean, when they went in, many of us were saying this makes no sense. They put their best men from, behind the defensive lines in the trenches where they're protected out in the open, and tens of thousands of them, young men, were slaughtered. Good soldiers, which the Ukrainians said. And what said, what is the point of this? They can't possibly hold it. Yet any dissent, any criticism was just denounced as, oh, well, that's a Kremlin talking point. But forwarding to now, the present time, nothing was achieved. They took massive casualties. They were chasing out, but there's no reflection, because anything that disrupts the war narrative that this everything is brilliant and any offensive is a good thing, it prevents this. With though the collapse of Pokrovsk now, this is a very strategic city though. What are the consequences of this city falling to the Russians?
Well, I mean, there's a it's a double-edged sword, and both edges are against the Ukraine side, because it is a tremendous morale destroyer for the Ukraine side, because their troops now see again that their command does not prioritize their lives. And instead of giving the order, when I was talking about when that mall was closing and it was still open, you could have gotten those guys out. They could have been brought to safety, lived to fight another day from stronger defensive positions where they could have imposed a higher cost on the Russians to advance. But instead, whether it's Sersky or Zelensky or the other commanders, they did not prioritize their lives. And now that they have allowed them to die in place, and there's some number of thousands of them that are completely behind enemy lines and surrounded now, and will either be captured and sent to POW camps, or they'll be killed in place. And so just imagine if you're in, let's say you're in Kupiansk, and say you're in some of those other areas up there, or in the Volchansk up in the Kharkiv area. You're like, well, what's going to happen if I get surrounded? My own people are going to allow me to just die in place for nothing. And if I can look and see you died for nothing in Avdiivka, in Bakhmut, in Kursk, in Khrinky, down on the Dnipro River before that, or in now Pokrovsk, why do I want to literally die for nothing when I know that my own country is just going to continue to blindly throw lives into the toilet? I just, at some point, even the most ardent nationalist are going to say, there's no point in this. I mean, we've already seen the desertions are up, according to one report I saw, in so far through 10 plus months of 2025, 500,000 people have deserted, and another couple of 100,000 ages 18 to 22 have fled the country just the last 2 months on that portion of it. And you can see at some point people are going to look around and go, I'm just going to join that group here. This is suicide to stay here, and nobody wants to commit suicide.
Yeah, I follow quite a few of these Ukrainian Telegram channels of different, military people from the Ukrainian side, and there's the decline in morale is quite obvious, and also anger often among their own political and military leadership. It stands in very stark contrast, though, to what you see often from Western politicians and media, where there's insist no surrender, no withdrawal, no negotiations. If they listen to these military Telegram channels of Ukrainians, they would probably call them Putinists for challenging the wisdom of holding on to every single inch despite all these massive losses.
Well, there was a speech given at Maastricht University on the 3rd of November, so just a few days ago, by General Ben Hodges. And I think that he gave the view that a lot of people were. He took President Trump to task and said he has had a losing strategy from the beginning. He said he doesn't understand anything about the history of the war, which is kind of odd because I don't know what history he's talking about here. But he said that he implied that he could have just given Putin an order to leave. He said he didn't even tell Russia to leave Ukraine. And he now asks Russia, Ukraine, to give up territory to get peace. And that's ridiculous, he says. So Russia is not winning. General Jack Keane on Fox News yesterday said Russia is not winning. So we just need to put more ammunition, more weapons, et cetera, in there, oblivious to everything we just talked about on the map and all the men that are dying and the people that are abandoning the fight. And like, no, just keep giving them more bullets to go in and keep dying. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. And especially in light of all these failures that have happened in the last year or so, why would you want to say, yeah, let's just keep on helping them die in large numbers when we see it's not going to work? And the Russian side does have all the numbers, and they have the ammunition and the industrial capacity, which I think you mentioned a second ago. And then you can say, we can't just tell Russia to leave because we can't make them leave. And yet that passes for elite thinking in the West. And it just puzzles me why we keep going down, why we keep listening to people like that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I've seen Ben Hodges contribute on different programs, and I'm always struck by the thought that if these were our men, our soldiers, we would have taken very, very different decisions. But again, the more they keep waving the Ukrainian flags, the more they, you know, the dishonest they seem, that these are mere, you know, lives to be thrown away. But you did mention these other cities which are falling, because Pokrovsk has already fallen. Siversk is now, well, semi-encircled, and also the Russians seems to have entered in the south. Kupiansk also encircled. You can have the Konstantinivka as well. But combined, these are very important cities along the main front line where all the defenses are. But together as well, if you look at Russia's key objective of taking Donetsk, then the two main cities of Slavyansk and Krematorsk, then Pokrovsk is just in the southwest, which allows them to push north and cover the cities from the west. Siversk is on the western side. Kupiansk is in the north. You have Konstantinovka in the south. If they take all the cities which are now being entered or encircled, all of them, these two huge cities of Slavyansk and Krematorsk could be encircled. I wouldn't say easy. It will take a while and of course, both blood and time. But that being said, do you see a wider collapse in Ukraine? Because even if it wasn't that strategic, which it's very strategic, but even if it wasn't, the loss of all this manpower, it makes the next battle so much more difficult.
Right. And see, that's why I specifically mentioned how this one of Pokrovsk played out, because you saw that Ukraine already used its last strategic theater reserves to try and to unblock that area in the northern part, north of Pokrovsk, which they didn't succeed at doing. And because they did that, they didn't have the troops down in the Kherson region. They didn't have it in the region just south of Pokrovsk, and they didn't have it in the city itself. So they had to pick and choose, and they lost here. And because all these other five cities you just mentioned there in Liman, also Siversk, and then in Kupiansk, because those are also simultaneously going on, the Ukraine just doesn't have enough manpower to be able to fight effectively in all of them. So they're starting to lose in virtually all of them, and especially where Russia focuses, puts a priority of effort, they're able to take that. So once they've completed the Pokrovsk and the Mirnograd circle, once that's taken care of, then all of those troops now can be applied elsewhere, and something else will move to the priority. Maybe Kramatorsk and Slavyansk, as you just mentioned there. And the problem is that now then Ukraine has even less troops. I mean, they could, in all total, it'll probably be a total of about 10,000 lost in this one pocket by itself. And I'm not sure how many are in Kupiansk, but a pretty solid number on top of that. Now then you have even less troops to go in to defend those two borders and those other two towns. And the bottom line is, at some point, it's just math. You're going to run out of troops and you're not going to be able to cover the front. Russia can. And at some point, you're just going to have a collapse of the front. There's just not enough men. And it's just inevitable. I don't know. It could literally be a year from now before that happens. I don't know. It could also be a month from now. It could happen before Christmas. But it is inevitable that it's going to happen. And the longer we go on pretending that mathematics don't apply and that you can continue to just have people slaughtered and there's never going to be a break, is just rolling the dice for no value whatsoever, because it's going to happen at some point, Glenn.
And whatever deal the Russians have, if we think they're harsh terms now, and I would fall in that category who thinks that terms are harsh, but they will only become much, much worse, I guess, once the strategic advantage increases on the Russian side. Just a quick last question, though. As we're now moving towards this more and more desperate situation for NATO and Zelensky, do you think there's any risk or chance that Europeans especially might, but of course Trump as well, might escalate in some way in an effort to rescue the situation? Because it seems a dangerous thing to do, because the Russians seems to have run out of patience and desperate to restore their deterrent. So there seems to be a dangerous dynamic here building up.
Yeah, I perceive that that's one of the reasons why Russia chose now to test its Burevestnik missile, what it claims is this nuclear-powered, nuclear-tipped cruise missile, why it chose now to do the Poseidon missile, etc., reinforcing that they have the Sarmat, is specifically saying it by name and talking about the Oreshnik and how they're operational now, etc. I think to say, don't test us. You have Mark Rutte earlier today in Romania was talking about, hey, yep, we are definitely going to defend every inch of NATO territory. And if anything happens, we'll have fleets of F-35s come flying in and all these battle tanks and everything like that. And Russia's listening to that and they're going, I wouldn't do that. And by the way, we're building up our forces too. And the way that they're doing now with their reserves and their recruitment folks that they bring in, and their conscripts, et cetera, they've changed the way they're doing it. So now they're building up about 3 million reserves that could be called upon on short notice. They're building up their reserves of all of these categories of drones, whether the Garands, the missiles, the artillery shells, refurbished tanks, other armored personnel carriers. Most of those are going into storage that they're rebuilding, because they're not using as many on the front lines now because they don't need to, because I think they're telling everybody, whether it's operational or strategic, we are superior militarily, and if you test us, it won't go well. And so don't test us. And instead, let's end this war. And let's get back to looking for security for everybody. Russia still is saying that. And I want to reemphasize something you just said a minute ago, because it's really important. The terms right now that for a negotiated settlement are still on the table, and they are, I call them ugly. The ugly terms, they're terrible from Ukraine's perspective, but they're not as bad as killing all the rest of their troops and taking everything up to the Dnieper River, and probably including Odessa up to the Transnistria, because I think all of that could fall too. So it can get much, much worse if Russia is required to take on the battlefield what they would otherwise settle for less on a negotiation table. And I think Russia is saying, look at what we're doing and look at what we have done and look at how this side is crumbling. Don't press a bad situation further. End it now. That's what we should do. We're given a golden opportunity here. And I just pray to God that we have the wisdom to take it, because if we don't, Glenn, you're going to get that situation that I just described there. Russia will take everything that they want on the battlefield, however long it takes.
Yeah, I get the impression that the Europeans might be, enhancing the rhetoric to some extent to make up for the fact that, the U.S. is reducing its military presence now in Central and Eastern Europe. So to compensate for the reduced capabilities, there's more, you know, beating the chest and speaking loud about...
And that's the opposite of what we should be doing. We should say, hey, look at that. Let's start going towards diplomacy, something that can actually produce positive outcomes, that can ensure your security, your prosperity, and the safety of all the people, and lower the chances of war. That's the wise thing to do. And I guess because of the mentality has just been locked in this thing really since 1992, and, you know, and all the way since 2014, let's just go back to there. I guess they just have this ossified brain cells, if that's a thing, that they can't think in ways that are rational and protective of their own interest. But I hope we figure out how to do that before it's too late.
Well, I wish NATO would give you a call for some advice there, because there seems to be a lack of common sense now. But thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're busy, so I very much appreciate it.
Always my pleasure, Glenn. Thanks for having me.